Nostalgia Production.
Remy Boy, yeah. 1738, I'm like, hey, what's up, hello? Since your pretty ass soon as you came in the door.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to yet another edition of the Builds on the Border podcast. It is Tuesday, August 11th, and we're coming to you live from our new Kansas studio. I'm joined in studio today with my friend Tommy Watson, my friend Bernie Johnson, and new to the podcast for the first time, Mr. Mark Hart. Mark, how you doing? And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tommy. It's good to be here.
We're glad to have you. Okay, so obviously we're just here tonight because we want to talk about, first and foremost, the outstanding performance by the newly christened to Kauffman Stadium Royal, Mr. Johnny Cueto, who pitched a gem of a baseball game last night in his first home start with Kansas City Royals. All four of us were out there having a great time out at the ballpark. He pitched complete game shutout, the first time a pitcher has pitched a complete game shutout in his appearance with his team midseason in 30 years. First time a player has done it, a complete game shutout in both leagues since Cliff Lee did it in 2009. So a pretty impressive moment. But I don't really want to talk about the history here. I want to talk about how impressive the environment was at the game last night. So I just want to get your guys' thoughts on how amazing the atmosphere was last night. It felt like playoff baseball. It felt like one of the most important regular season games since the Royals clinched a playoff spot last year. Let's kind of just go around and talk about the experience last night, being at the ballpark and witnessing a very historic moment for the Royals last night. Tommy, why don't you start us off?
All right, so the crowd was impressive. It was fantastic. I don't know if it was if it wasn't a sellout, it was really close. But anyway,
for a Monday night. I mean, that crowd was so into it and so loud and packed to the rafters.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways, I kept thinking about how like 10 years ago when the Royals sucked and like all we wanted to do was just compete, and here we are now just leading our division by more than 10 games over the next closest team, over Minnesota. I mean, this is what we dreamed about 10 years ago, going to a game on a Monday night, sellout crowd, and it was just electric. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, I think kind of a lot's been said for other franchises, you know, like our cross-state rivals, the Cardinals, who have, like, incredible atmosphere every single game. That is something the Royals now have, and we have one of the most impressive home records in baseball. We're top three in home records in baseball. And last night showed why we're one of the toughest places to play in major leagues. Mark Brody, what are you guys' thoughts?
Well, exactly to your point. I mean, Johnny Cueto recognized the crowd last night.
Yeah.
As we started chanting, go Cueto, go, and just chanting for him to come out and every inning getting a standing ovation.
Like, everybody I talked to said that they could hear the let's go Cueto, like almost as much as I could hear the announcers last night. And, you know, the fact that I heard that in the dugout, Cueto wasn't necessarily going to go for that ninth inning, but he said to Yost in the dugout, look, after that ovation, I'm going out there and I'm pitching another inning. Well, his pitch count got pretty high. I think he threw over 110
116,
pitches.
116
pitches. I mean, it was just so cool. And as we speak, the Royals just get off to another great lead with a home run. Is it a home run?
Yes.
By Eric Hosmer. And Brody, what you were just saying a moment ago, before we got on, we have like the most runs scored in the first inning in Major League Baseball by like a landslide.
It's incredible how well we were doing in the first. And I think Tommy said that we're 29-9.
We are 29-9 when leading up to the first inning.
Yeah, that's incredible. And like, you know, we were tailgating last night. We were having a good time out in the parking lot, enjoying our Busch Light and our Fireball whiskey. By the time we got in the game, the first inning, we only missed the first inning, and we already embraced a 3-0 lead, which, you know, we added that later on in the game. But we didn't even we missed the three winning runs of the game last night, and Cueto just shut the Tigers down from there. And the Tigers, you know, they gave up kind of at the trade deadline, you know, mortgaging away kind of a lot of different guys to try and, you know, build for the future. But you know, we played a phenomenal game of baseball last night.
And Tommy, you bring up an interesting point. I looked into this a little bit today after last night's game, and part of the reason the crowd was so amped and so excited is that Johnny Cueto's performance was really impressive. Since July 4th, you're talking about a Tigers offense that ranks first in OPS and slugging percentage in the American League.
Yeah.
Formidable lineup, and he went out there and put together 9 great innings of shutout baseball.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the crowd was responding to. in addition to the excitement of having an ace here in Kansas City to hopefully help us make a run in October.
And he's had two solid away starts, but his fastball was kind of pedestrian in those first two starts of the Royals, getting just three strikeouts and eight swings and misses in the two games combined. Like, that's not really the Cueto that the Reds fans were used to. It wasn't really the Cueto we were expecting to get. Now, given his earned run average in those games was pretty solid. He didn't give up more than three runs in those starts. But hitters were 2 of 15 against his fastball last night after going 10 for 29 against the pitch in his first two starts. He was efficient essentially with all of his pitches, but his fastball looked particularly effective against that formidable, Tigers lineup, minus
Cabrera and
Cespedes, who was traded to the Mets.
Again, keep in mind, they're leading the American League even after losing Cabrera since July 4th.
Yeah, and again, that's just a testament to, still how formidable that Detroit offense is, even minus some of the guys we thought were, really integral pieces. Looking forward now, we're basically two-thirds of the way through the season. There are about 50-some-odd games left on the schedule for the Royals. I think we can expect more solid starts from Jonathan Cueto. That's a given. I think the things that we really need to work on going forward is, we obviously want to see more consistent starts from Danny Duffy and Yordano Ventura. Those are going to be two guys we rely on pretty heavily. That said, Chris Medlin has really impressed me in his recent outings with the Royals. He's pitched some fantastic, extended innings, and he's a guy that, if Yordano Ventura continues to struggle, and some have said that he deserved to be sent down last week, may even enter the starting rotation, and then we can put, insert a guy like Chris Young into those guys who could have given us those long innings, later in games in the postseason. What do you guys expect kind of just down the stretch here?
I guess I'd expect the Royals to, like you said, get Duffy to mature up, that they can, overcome the struggles they've had, get more innings. Because what they need to do is they need to get more innings out of these guys because, the bullpen fades towards the end of the season. And that is one of our top strengths. That's our most consistent thing we've had the last 2 years. And that's our key weapon for winning the games in the playoffs. And so I think it's maybe the most important thing for them to have a fully rested bullpen, which we're getting a lot of help from the rest of our division. Originally I was worried about the lack of competition we're getting from the rest of our division, but that could turn out to be good because by the end of the season we may clinch real early on.
And rest a lot of our guys.
Yeah, we can start resting people. We don't have to worry about winning games. I mean, we may settle for just maybe 95 wins rather than trying to go for 100 just so we can keep our bullpen fresh and ready to go for the playoffs.
Yeah, and the American Central has not been – we're not the – by any means, the golden boys of baseball in terms of our division, competitiveness. We have a 12-game lead over the Twins right now. On the other foot, our National League, counterparts in the National League Central, the Cardinals have the most wins in baseball, but they're also trailed right behind by the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Chicago Cubs. I'd rather have our divisional situation than a National League Central situation where those guys are essentially going to be playing postseason baseball in the last 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah.
It's going to be nice for the Royals to take the foot off the gas a little bit, get guys like Gordon, who's going to need some rest games, coming forward. That groin injury is not something that just goes away overnight. Even when he comes back, I bet it will still be nagging him a little bit. And those opportunities were not just with pitching, but with our everyday starters we can give some rest to also. With Gordon eventually coming back in the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a logjam in terms of guys that need playing time. You've got Paul Orlando, who has, shown some timely hitting for the Royals this year. Ben Zobrist, who has been great since we acquired him just a few weeks ago. And then you have Alex Rios, who, showed some really strong consistency after the Gordon injury, but has kind of reverted back to his old ways of not really timely hitting and, very subpar defense. We saw that last night. He had a catch that he could make at the wall that looked pretty pitiful in terms of, I think all of us agreed at the time, we almost would rather have Nori Aoki out there making some, ridiculous behind-the-bat catch. And then, of course, you got Jared Dyson, who will merit some innings as well. I mean, he's played fantastic for this team in terms of getting on base and getting bases for this team. So who do you think is the odd man out once Gordon returns from injury? Because I know who my guy is, but I'd like to kind of hear your thoughts on who gets kind of pushed out of the rotation of outfielders that we're going to be having.
Orlando.
You think Orlando?
Orlando.
It's unfortunate. Yeah, and I was going to say, it's Paul Orlando. I think he hasn't had the body of work to merit that spot. I would love to think that it'd be Alex Rios, but why don't you kind of elaborate on that a little bit more, Brody?
Well, we've seen it already this year multiple times where even though Orlando came up and had his first three hits, it's triples, and then has gotten power. And the walk-off grand slam, he's a great hitter, a great outfielder, but I mean, it is a logjam, as you were saying, of too many guys for too few positions.
Yeah. So it's unfortunate, but I think that's how it works out. So looking forward, see what the Royals have left this season. You know, after this series against Detroit, we play a 4-game set against the Angels, which will get us to Sunday. Of those remaining games, though, we only play 4 opponents with a 500 or above record. Those being the Angels, the Orioles, who we match up with twice, the Rays, who are sitting right at 500 and have essentially given up on the season, because I think it's, you know, either the Yankees are going to hold pat and win that division, or the Blue Jays are going to run away with it. I don't really think that the Rays have a realistic shot at the playoffs. And of course, the 1-game set we play against Chicago. So we don't play a lot of talented teams moving forward, but we do play a lot of divisional opponents, which can prove to be hard because of the familiarity. Looking forward, what do you see as the big series for us? You know, I think you can look at the Baltimore series, you can look at the Angels series, but I also think it's going to be important to send a message to the rest of the division that we are the best team and will continue to be the best team in this division for years to come. What are you guys' thoughts on the remaining slated games?
Well, look, I think we've made it clear from the get-go that we can sort of handle the Central, or at least we have been able to up until this point. Now our margin of leading is dwindled at some points, but I think we've done a pretty good job of asserting our dominance, if you will. Now, it depends whether that will continue, but I feel confident that it will, especially with the moves that were made around the trade deadline. The one thing that will be interesting is how, especially some of the younger guys like Ventura, respond to firepower on a team like the Angels, for instance.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's been there before, but I think we can all agree the Ventura this year maybe is a little bit different than the Ventura that we saw last year.
Right, not the same guy. We're not getting the same guy. But hopefully we can see him kind of adjust it to some way of consistency. Consistency besides his only consistent thing right now being really walking guys and kind of loading up the bases for himself and having to get himself out of jams. That's kind of the Ventura we've gotten to know over the last couple of months, even after kind of the send down, call back up after the Vargas injury. So there's a lot to look forward to. I think it's safe to say that this team will most likely make the postseason as a divisional winner, so we won't have to worry about a play-in game, although that was probably the most exciting moment of the postseason last year, on par with the World Series. I'm excited for postseason baseball. I'm excited for October, and I'm excited that the four of us will be all together in Kansas City for it. I mean, you guys were in Columbia last year. You obviously made your way over here plenty of times to watch games, but we'll all be around.
I think I can speak for Brody in saying that we'll enjoy not having to get up at 5 in the morning to make it back for an 8 a.m. engineering
class. Yes, yes.
I'm going to be the only one in class now. This is going to suck. All right, well, moving on from the Royals, I want to touch on the Chiefs a little bit. First, I want to talk about Will Shields' induction ceremony. I just want to touch on it really briefly because it's always a special moment. You know, when Willie Rofe got inducted in the Hall of Fame a few years ago, that was a really special moment for Chiefs fans, but he wasn't a lifelong Chief. He had stints with other teams. Will Shields was a lifelong Chief, and, you know, throughout our time growing up watching him, he was really a staple. You know, one thing we always had growing up was, you know, role models on that team, especially Will Shields, and just the exemplary character that he showed. He was the Walter Payton Man of the Year at one point in his career. And he really showed the quality of human being he is in his acceptance speech for his Hall of Fame induction. Tommy, Will Shields, Nebraska Cornhusker, one of the, you know, the most famous linemen in NFL history, at least in the modern era. Why don't you talk a little bit about his speech, because I know it's fresh in your mind, what it meant to you, you know, what it means to our generations of guys who grew up with him as kind of an idol. And how that speech kind of impacted you.
You know, I was very impressed with the speech. I loved how his central theme was that it wasn't just him. At one point he said it takes a village. And
yeah.
He made sure to thank, I think, pretty much anyone who's ever impacted his life. He basically talked for 7 minutes and just named people. He named all his coaches. He called Dick Vermeil a good friend still.
Yeah, I mean, he name-dropped in, like, the coolest way possible. The only way that's really appropriate name-dropping is when you name-drop all the people you're grateful to for making
for making it to the NFL Hall of Fame.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an honored club. I mean, being in the NFL itself makes you a part of an honored club. But getting on and put that tan jacket, man, that's one of the coolest things. Brody, what were your thoughts on kind of the whole induction ceremony and kind of what it meant to you to watch Will Shields get inducted to the Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, just having watched him growing up as being truly like the dominant force on one of the best offensive lines I think the NFL has ever seen.
Yeah.
He was an offensive lineman. You could watch like highlights of just him doing stuff. I know there were several things last week that people were posting getting ready for his induction. And there, one of them was
the Ray Lewis.
Ray Lewis was mic'd up, and he's just complaining at Will Shields about how he's trying to do his job. Will Shields is just owning it.
Yeah,
it just owning it.
There was another good play where Priest Holmes breaks about a 60-yard run for a touchdown off of a sweep, and Will Shields is running step for step with him basically the whole way.
And you know it was a 39-29 sweep, and so that means that. You know, Will Shields in the right guard. He pulls, and yeah, he was leading him the whole time. And, you know, they had the man who introduced Will Shields, and his name escapes me now, talked about, you know, kind of Will's, you know, humbleness. And he talked about the moment that he realized that Will Shields was like an exemplary talent. And he asked Will that he was going to, you know, he was that NFL All-Pro talent. He asked Will, so was that guy that you were, you know, having to pick up most of the game, is he just not very, very good? And he said, no. Will goes, no. He will be one of the best players in the National Football League at some point. I can't remember who the player was, but Will Shields made a guy who was destined to be an All-Pro look like, you know, he's playing peewee football against, you know, one of the best linemen in football. So it was a really cool moment, and that brings me to a topic of discussion that I've wanted to bring up because, you know, we've had a guy on the Chiefs roster who's been with us for a long time, and I think he's, you know, been a part of the organization with the Chiefs from start to finish in his career. And I think he's the next likely guy to be inducted in the Hall of Fame if he continues on the trajectory that he's on. And that's Jamaal Charles. I think he's the next Chief that has a likely shot at being inducted into the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. But he's not done yet. So there's a lot of things I think he has left to do to get to that point. If you do agree, or if you disagree, why don't you talk about the reasons you think Jamaal Charles will make the Hall of Fame, and or reasons why he should make the Hall of Fame, or what you think he still needs to do in his career to, you know, get his bust put into Canton, Ohio.
Well, I personally think he needs to play maybe 3 or 4 good seasons of what he's been giving us for basically the last 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always just found that I feel like he's still underrated sometimes. Like, everyone still knows he's a you know, one of the top 3 running backs in the league right now, top 4, top mm-hmm. 5, I guess. But he's in the top 5 of all time. I'm not sure. I think he might be the leader in yards per carry.
Yeah, he's the leader ahead of Jim Brown.
Well, was it 2 years ago that he almost broke
the record?
Was
a single season record.
0.01 away from?
Yeah, I think
he was
5.6.
5.7,
and he had 5.6.
That's right. Yeah.
But I mean, I've always thought that's kind of an underrated stat because I mean, that's what as a running back, that's what you want from the running back. You want him to get yards per play.
Right. And statistically, by that model, if you gave Jamaal Charles the ball every single time, you get a first down every 2 plays.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a really impressive back.
Guess,
Mark, you were going to say something.
Well, oftentimes you look at a stat like that and you say there's a great offensive line behind that, right?
When Priest Holmes set the single season touchdown record.
It turned around and we had Larry Johnson put together some great seasons as well. I don't think you can make that same argument with the offensive lines that Jamaal
Charles
has had.
No,
we've had some bright spots here and there, but the overall quality is not what we had when Priest Holmes was running here in Kansas City. And I think it speaks to the guy's talent. Hopefully it'll be recognized on a national level. I agree with you, Tommy, that he needs a few more seasons to definitively say this guy's a Hall of Famer or this guy isn't a Hall of Famer. The jury's still out.
Right, but I think if he keeps up on that level, he stays consistent with his, you know, trajectory thus far. And, you know, there are some, you know, if you look at who are other running backs at his age at 29, there's a fall off once those legs collect some miles, especially when they're the legs of Jamaal Charles, who essentially has had to carry this offense for better half of a decade. He says, you know, he feels fresher than ever, but he's, you know, he's been plagued by injuries before in the past, whether it was the ACL tear or the hip injury. So we'll see. But he's the next guy, I think, in terms of not just his talent, but his character that has made such an impact on the Kansas City Chiefs organization. He kind of sets the tone, leads by example there, and, you know, continues to be, you know, a role model. You know, we saw him at the Special Olympics, you know, kickoff ceremony, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and his impassioned speech about his, you know, experience with the Special Olympics. And, you know, I just think he's a high character guy, and those are the kind of guys you want, you know, in the Hall of Fame, you know, in Canton, Ohio. So, We'll finish talking about Hall of Fame Chiefs, but we'll talk about a guy who's been a really special part of this Chiefs organization for a couple of years now and is now back on the practice field. Eric Berry has now been cleared to play and cleared to practice now for about, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks. You know, we all had experiences with people that have had cancer in our lifetime. And it's a really cool moment to see Eric Berry back on the field. You know, he's been working out with the second unit, but all reports say that he's been playing really well in training camp. Why don't we talk a little bit about, you know, how special that is for somebody that had cancer literally a year, was diagnosed almost a year ago to this month, and is now back on the football. I'm sorry, what was it, 2 years
ago? No, it was about November last year.
Less than a year, and he's back on the field. That's amazing, right? I mean, that's, you know, kind of unheard of.
He actually gained weight doing chemo too, by the way.
Yeah, and he took a pretty risky, he took a much more difficult chemotherapy procedure so that he could continue to work out while he was undergoing therapy. And, you know, if that doesn't show you what kind of teammate he is and what kind of professional he is, you know, to go through that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he took another season off to recover, you know, from that. But he didn't. He kept on trying to better himself as an athlete while you have one of the most debilitating diseases, you know, that you know, we know of and that people have had to go through. So I think it's really special. And, you know, I've always been a fan of Eric Berry, but, you know, I just think it's really cool. What are you guys' thoughts?
Well, let's take a look. You know, a step back and say beyond Kansas City, because I think we all agree the town has gotten behind him. 100% support for Eric Berry. It's been great to see. What's interesting to me is that it's extended beyond Kansas City. Around the league, guys are recognizing Eric's struggle, you know, from the point that he was diagnosed to treatment and later recovery. Chuck Pagano wearing, you know, an Eric Berry solidarity t-shirt in practice. I think it says a lot about what he means, not just to Kansas City, because I think it's a well-established fact he means a lot to this town. But around the league, he's been recognized.
And not just around the league, but to people who aren't even, you know, around football. You know, he's an inspiration to people outside of the sport, too. He's an inspiration to anybody with cancer to say, look, you know, cancer is not a death sentence. Cancer does not mean your life stops. It means you just got to, you know, rally, have people that care about you rally around you and fight through it. And he, you know, he fought it, and he, you know, the jury, you know, not the jury still out, but, you know, it's kind of a wait and see kind of moment, because you know, cancer, as we know, is one of those things that can come back. But for now, you know, I just hope that Eric Berry can, you know, enjoy being back on the practice field, because I know the team is enjoying having him back, because he was one of those guys that was a leader on that defense, vocally and by performance. And, you know, to have one of the, you know, I'd say arguably one of the top five safeties in the league for his career back on the field, I mean, it not only does it help the team out, but, you know, It motivates other people that are going through a similar thing. And, you know, we heard today that, you know, Flip Saunders, the head coach, president, and general manager of the Timberwolves, now has a very treatable form of Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, I wouldn't be surprised if Eric Berry is one of those guys who reaches out and, you know, talks, you know, reaches out to somebody who's in the world of professional sports, you know, reaches out from, you know, across football and basketball lines, you know, to talk to him about it and, you know, help Flip Saunders now, who's going to go through that illness, and try to continue and coach and run as an executive over with the Timberwolves. So obviously, our thoughts and prayers to Coach Flip, to Coach Saunders, and hoping that he has a quick and easy recovery while he battles. You know, again, you know, he battles cancer. So we hope for the best there. And I think, again, I just want to reiterate, it's great to see Eric Berry back out on the practice field. So shifting gears away from the Chiefs, but staying with football, I want to talk about an interesting story that came up today. Geno Smith is now out 6 to 8 weeks with a fractured jaw. He was sucker punched by his own teammate. And I'm not great with his name, but his name is Ik Nwankwo-Pally, who has already been dismissed from the team. He's one of the reserve linebackers for the Jets. And the dispute, now we learn, was over $600. A $600 plane ticket that Nwankwo-Pally purchased for Geno Smith so he could attend a football camp that he was hosting. Well, a friend of Geno Smith's died in a motorcycle accident in Miami, so Smith did not attend the camp. And Nwankwo-Pally demanded that the Jets quarterback refund him the $600 he allegedly used to purchase the plane ticket. Now, I'm not doubting the fact that the plane ticket probably cost a couple hundred dollars, but I'm sure that it probably didn't cost $600 for someone to take a domestic flight. That's almost unheard of, especially when he's a pro athlete as well. I mean, again, I'm not saying pro athletes are any different from us in the fact that they're saving, but, you know, I know that if I was making a professional athlete's salary and any one of you guys had a friend, a close friend that died tragically, my expectation would not be that you reimbursed me for the ticket, because I would have just been grateful that you had already agreed to come and speak at my training camp. You're my teammate. Teammate essentially is like a brotherhood, and I would have been sympathetic, and I would not have asked for that $600 back. And even if I had asked that $600 back, I wouldn't have punched you in the face and, you know, put your career at risk if you didn't get that money back to me in a prompt manner. I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. What are your guys' thoughts on this situation? Because, well, it's been all over Twitter today.
I think you're putting a little too much blame on Enkapaya. Like, I'm not saying, like, that it's, like, not – I mean, that he didn't do something stupid. I'm just saying I don't think it's like he just went up to Geno Smith in the locker room and was like, you owe me $600. And then when Geno didn't want to pay up, he punched him. And I think it was more like, you know, obviously he gave Geno probably a little bit of time to grieve after what happened. And he said, hey – you know, look, I bought this plane ticket. I know you couldn't make out. I don't blame you for that. But, you know, you think you could reimburse me. And, you know, that camp was a month ago. And so they've been together every day. And, you know, it's $600, which to a pro athlete is probably not a lot. But, I mean, when you think about it from his perspective, he's like a third-string guy who's barely making it.
Right.
Versus Geno Smith on a multi-million-dollar contract. It would be nothing to Geno Smith to just go up to an ATM after practice one day and get $600.
Well, also, but the league's minimum practice salary is $250,000.
But still,
and okay, and just thinking of long-term finances, Enkapaya costs himself a lot more than $600.
Well, no, I'm not saying that wasn't a stupid move. It was definitely a stupid move to punch him, because that was easily, it's an easy decision for them to cut him. He's a third-string guy versus the guy who's their multi-million-dollar quarterback.
I think that we're all kind of getting at the same point here, and that is, yes, it's reasonable to ask for the $600. He was owed it. He paid it. He was reasonable in asking. Now, somewhere in between him asking and Geno responding, things got out of hand, and punches were thrown. I don't think anyone's, you know, advocating for physical or the physical altercation that took place. But that being said, if the guy was owed $600, he was owed $600.
Well, I don't think it was an issue of the reason. I wouldn't have a problem if it turned into a scuffle and a punch was thrown and Geno Smith's jaw was broken, because I'm sure that Geno Smith exchanged some words that probably weren't too friendly. He said some things. But the fact that it's been categorized as a sucker punch is essentially hitting somebody that has no way of defending himself. And I'm guessing it came at a time that Geno Smith wasn't really ready for it. It wasn't like it turned into a scuffle or a shoving match. It was essentially a sucker punch, which is how everyone's categorizing it. And I think, you know, according to Todd Bowles' report, the head coach of the Jets, once Enkapaya realized what he had done wrong, he was very apologetic and very remorseful. But, you know, sucker punches, I mean, when you hit somebody that can't defend themselves, especially when you're an NFL linebacker, I just think that's so inexcusable, especially over, you know, probably less than a day's worth of pay. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous, and I think completely inexcusable. I mean, I guess we're kind of on different wavelengths here, but I just think Enkapaya didn't think at all through this entire scenario. One, from asking for his teammate, you know, who, like I said, being a teammate on every level, especially in the game of football, is like kind of, they're like your brother to an extent. Asking him to pay back the $600 after the loss of a friend, which, you know, we know has residual effects beyond just a month. Even if the camp was a month away, I would not be rushing my teammate to get me $600 back if he had just lost a close friend. I just think from my perspective, and I know I'm not in the shoes of an NFL linebacker, the pressure and the expectation, but at no point would I ever expect myself to let it escalate to that level. And if I was a GM or a head coach, I wouldn't want a guy who was prone to those kind of unexpected outbursts and those behaviors to be around my locker room, because he sounds like a toxic person. He sounds like somebody I wouldn't want to have to coach, no matter what his talent level was. Somebody that's willing to, you know, put another man's livelihood and his career and his life at stake that way. I think it's just inexcusable.
Well, whose livelihood was ended ultimately as a result of this?
And it complied, but that's something that he brought upon himself.
I guess what I'm saying is maybe it says something about Geno's leadership in the locker room. If he's not paying guys back for money that he owes them, or however you want to slice it, you don't see Tom Brady getting sucker punched. You don't see Troy Aikman getting sucker punched. You don't see leaders of teams. You don't see Alex Smith getting sucker punched. You don't see quality leaders of teams that can't control themselves and control the team in the locker room.
Yeah, and I guess I'm realizing now that I'm kind of not assigning enough blame on Smith, who probably was as at fault leading up to the altercation and not addressing it in probably a mature way and thinking he can skirt by. But I just think it's, you know, it is childish from both sides, but, you know, and I think both of them are eventually going to have to take responsibility for it. But I don't know, it's just, it's unfortunate because the NFL is trying to uphold this image in the midst of all this scrutiny that it still has quality men in their locker rooms. When you hear something like that, you wonder what kind of that environment is being, being cast on to these players on a daily basis. I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, it's kind of unfortunate. There were probably like 20 witnesses to what happened, but the way the NFL runs these days, I doubt the Jets are going to let anyone give the first-hand account of what happened.
Right. And, okay, just to bring up this point, that this is not Anagampali's first brush with violence. In fact, when he was in college at Louisiana Tech, a fight broke out and he punched an off-duty cop who was working security at the bar. And on that night, Anagampali had to be subdued first with pepper spray and then a stun gun. He was charged with battery on a police officer and disturbing the peace and being drunk, publicly intoxicated. The charge was amended to simple battery, I assume because he probably had a pretty good lawyer, and he received a suspended jail sentence and was placed on 13-month probation and was ordered to perform 32 hours of community service and complete an anger management course. I don't think the anger management course worked based off the events of today, but it's not his first brush with an incident like this. So I don't care. Again, I'm saying I don't care what Geno Smith may have said. I don't care how much money Geno Smith owed him. Actually, I do care how much he owed him because if it was some ridiculous number, it was over $1,000. And I think I take it back. I'm not going to put a price on whether or not you should sucker punch somebody. But, I think Anagampali clearly has some other personal issues he's dealing with from an emotional perspective. I don't know. I place 90% of the blame on Anagampali for what happened today, and maybe 10%, if that, on Geno Smith.
Yeah, I mean, I think the anger issue probably played into it. I would guess that they were talking, they got a little more heated. Geno Smith probably said something that hit a chord with him, and that probably would just, socked him right there, because I believe that qualifies as sucker punch.
Yeah.
Not to belabor the point too much, but you're talking about, starting quarterback, third string linebacker. So there's naturally a tendency that,
right.
I am in a position where I can do what I want, and you are not. You are a third string scrub.
Right. Who might not even be here in 4 weeks.
And we weren't in the locker room, so it's hard to quantify blame and the sense of percentages. But I guess my point here is that truly great leaders of teams aren't involved in things like this.
And they don't even let it get to that point.
Exactly.
I agree with you. All right. Well, kind of moving on, we want to get into a topic that unfortunately Mark doesn't have a whole lot of information on. But we are going to talk about the True Detective finale. And I just want to start off by saying that I was in from the beginning with True Detective Season 2. Even after a couple of weeks of rough episodes where it didn't really seem like the writer, Nick Pizzolatto, had a lot of general direction or idea of where he wanted this story to go. There were a lot of overlapping stories, a lot of intertwining characters. There were four main characters, which already made it difficult to fill an entire hour of television with cohesive storylines that don't kind of step all over each other and drag you away from the tension lying elsewhere. But he also had like 45 tertiary characters, guys that weren't really playing a significant role, but they were people that we, in order to understand what's happening in the show, we had to know who they were and understand what their roles were. There wasn't a whole lot of, exposition leading into this eight-episode arc. And, I only really watched the finale because I wanted to see how it was going to end. I didn't really care anymore about the characters. I didn't really care anymore about what was going on. I just wanted this thing to be over. So before we get into the specifics of what happened last night, I just want to get your guys' general thoughts on the season, kind of from start to finish, and what you liked or disliked about the show. And Tommy, let's just start with you.
Well, so I think actually this show probably had more just single exciting moments than last season. Mm-hmm. But I thought this season was just so confusing with all the characters. It was just so convoluted, like you couldn't follow it very well. I felt like normally I don't need to read something to know what happened. Mm-hmm. And I found myself every Monday reading it, make like more than one review to find out what I just watched, right, and how that's going to affect the next episode. And I think that's what frustrated me the most.
Yeah, I kept on thinking, this would make sense if these were individual storylines that were built over like several seasons of like seeing the rise of Frank Semien, seeing the criminal nature and of Ray Velcoro emerge after the rape of his wife, seeing Annie Bezzarides, trying to adjust to a normal life after the traumatic experiences of childhood. And then Ray, or not, sorry, not Ray, Paul Woodruff adjusting to life after the tour of duty he served over in the Middle East, you know, coming to grips with his homosexuality and all those things. Those are all things that needed something, you know, preemptively to get us to where we are today because there wasn't enough background. Brody, what are your thoughts?
You know, having seen it or watched it on Sunday night and just had a few days to rethink different things, there's significant changes he should have done to the show. It would have made it a lot better. Either have it extended into multiple seasons or maybe...
just a longer season.
A longer season, or even better would just be Bezzariti starting off in the, was it Venezuela? Or where they run?
Yeah.
Having
and
that
it,
scene...
and it be a story.
And having it be like the first season where you have McConaughey and Harrelson kind of doing present day and
recollection of what happened.
Exactly. Just to give like some...
that would have been a good idea.
Yeah. Because it, I mean, it's a great... it was a great like detective story of they start off with a murder, ends up the murder has nothing to do with
right.
this huge conspiracy that they fall into, and they solve it, but they don't get it public, and it's all... I mean, it's a good story, but he just added way too much extra.
So much detail, so many extra characters stealing away time where we could have been learning more about these other characters. And, you know, I was critical at first of, you know, Vince Vaughn's performance as Frank Semien, not because I thought Vince Vaughn wasn't doing a good job, but I don't think his lines were very well written for him. But I eventually started to really enjoy the character of Frank Semien, and there were things about him that I thought were really redeemable. The fact that he was somebody who was willing to work for his successes and not let something like, you know, a bunch of crooked businessmen take advantage of him. I thought the season could have focused just on Frank Semien and Ray Velcoro and a little bit of Annie Bezzarides. I do really like Taylor Kitsch. You know, Tim Riggins is my boy from Friday Night Lights. I think he's a good actor, but I just don't think his part was well written in the show. And
I think it was totally unnecessary.
Exactly. I don't think he was really... he didn't add anything.
You could take that whole thing out. Everything he did this season, and I don't think would have made
right.
that
like the,
difference.
I think the only part was when he gets killed,
and
it makes it so that
they can
Bezzariti and Velcoro
get blamed for his murder.
Get blamed for it, and it like makes them closer together.
Right.
And it's like, you don't need Woodrow.
Yeah, you didn't. And I like Taylor Kitsch a lot. I think he's a great actor. I just think this wasn't a performance where he got to show, number one, how talented of an actor he is, or two, really have any point in the show. Like we said, he was only really there to get killed and have them framed for murder. Sunday night's episode was entertaining. I thought there were some cool scenes, especially when Ray Velcoro, you know, enters that mall, that shopping center, you know, wearing that kind of very conspicuous, because he was trying to keep a low profile, but I don't know how you keep a low profile with that white cowboy hat he was wearing. And that scene was interesting. Obviously, the scene with his son, where he sees him for the last time, was interesting and heartfelt, and, you know, ended up ultimately leading to the demise of Ray Velcoro, who I thought was the most enjoyable character, and I thought Colin Farrell's performance was the strongest on the show this year. And I did like the moment where, you know, Ray's ex-wife opens the, you know, the envelope to find the results of the parentage, you know, the blood test to find out if Ray was truly his father, and he was. And I think that, you know, that was a cool moment because I think that would have been a cooler central story to the True Detective thing. Ray trying to manage this life with his son and trying to have a life with his son while also trying to escape the pressures of being a crooked cop and being, you know, essentially, you know, a guy who's committing crimes for Frank Semien. I just think there were so many intriguing things that they could have delved into if they tried to leave all this other external crap by the wayside. And I think for the future of True Detective to have another season, you know, in this anthology series, which is why I think, you know, they weren't really ever thinking outside of the box of that anthology series, because it's going to be one season covering one story. But I think for the sake of its survival, I think you have to remove Nick Pizzolatto as the writer. I think you have to have one director for the entire season with one consistent vision, because I don't think we saw any one episode that was similar to the other in terms of the way that
it was shot, or
the way that the actors were instructed to portray their characters. I just thought there were so many glaring inconsistencies, and there wasn't a Cary Fukunawa to rescue the show from Nick Pizzolatto and kind of the pitfall of his writing, which essentially failed everybody for 8.5 hours this summer. It's 8.5 hours that I wish I could have back. You can be quite honest. I don't think this is a story that I'm ever going to look back on and say, oh, I really liked that season. You know, season one of True Detective was great, and it did kind of leave a bittersweet taste in your mouth with the way the finality played out last year, because it didn't get as existential as we hoped it would. Mm-hmm. But then it just got so much worse this season, and it's unfortunate because I like that show. I mean, I liked the performances of Harrelson and McConaughey, and I liked the performances of Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell this season. But for it to have life again, I think you got to remove Pizzolatto. Ty, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm necessarily on board with that. I think now that we've seen kind of both ends of the spectrum, we've seen really good and pretty much what we can agree is not very good.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how season three plays out.
If there is a season three.
But I'm going to have a tight leash on a season three. If I'm as confused as I was three episodes into this season, I'm probably going to stop
out
watching.
Early. Yeah, I agree. And I'll say again this week, if you guys are disappointed with True Detective and you want to watch a show that probably won't disappoint you, go watch Mr. Robot on USA. It's very, very good. Mark, have you seen Mr. Robot on USA?
No, I haven't.
No, you should check it out. You can get it pretty much anywhere on the internet. And I think if you go on USA On Demand online, you can watch like the first 5 episodes for free. All right, so I think that pretty much covers everything we wanted to talk about tonight on the Built and Border podcast. Mark, first thoughts, impressions of your first appearance here on the podcast?
Overall impression, very positive. It was, you know, a continuation of conversations that we have a lot, maybe a little bit more dressed up than we normally have.
Like, yeah.
Or, shall I say, less crass.
Yeah, less crass.
but I'm happy to be here and, you know, happy to be a part of it. So it's a good feeling to be finally built on the border.
Yeah. Well, you were built on the border, essentially. And you grew up, you know, a block away from me growing up, so... So you lived, you know, 2 blocks away from the border, right? So you were built on the border. I mean, your life was built on the border.
That's why we call it that?
That's just
took him 22 episodes.
I don't think anyone's disputing my credentials. I'm happy to be part of the show.
Yeah. All right. Well, for Mark Hart, Brody Johnson, and Tommy Randolph, we want to say thanks to you guys for listening. For Brody Johnson, Mark Hart, Tommy Watson, and myself. Did I say Tommy Randolph and myself? Yeah. I'm so sorry. that was a flub. We want to say thanks for listening. You guys can continue to interact with us on Twitter at BorderKC or on our email at our email address. Submit comments, suggestions, questions for the show at builtontheborder@gmail.com. We played you guys in with Fetty Wap's Trap Queen because Fetty Wap's out at the K tonight, which is pretty awesome. He's out hanging with the crew. He's out hanging with Lorenzo Cain and Salvador Perez, and he's getting to watch the boys in blue win, like, you know, they'll probably win 17-38, scoring 38 runs against the Tigers tonight. What are you guys' thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's probably good.
Maybe it'll be one of the 17-38 best games we see all season. I don't know. So we're going to play you guys out with another track we've been listening to a lot lately this week. And that song's going to be Empress by Morningsiders. So we hope you guys enjoy. We hope you guys continue to enjoy the great summer weather we're going to have here throughout the month of August. Continue to enjoy the Royals and their winning ways as we coast to hopefully a divisional title this year. So again, join us next week for some more Royals talk, some Chiefs training camp discussion, and hopefully some more intriguing pop culture stories that we can cover for you guys. So for the rest of the crew, have a great week out there. Enjoy it. Peace. It's running through my veins. Cause I
dressed you as you may.